Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. And now, Star Fuentes.
Welcome. This is Star. After the half hour, you can call in at 646-716-9663, and you can get a reading. I'll answer your questions. We'll chat with you about different topics. So, I would like to start talking about Buddhism and mindfulness. I have a friend named Kevin Griffin. Kevin, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Star.
Great. Kevin, could you tell us about your spiritual path?
Well, I guess I think my whole life has been a spiritual path, but I only realized that probably when I got sober, maybe before that. You know, I had to go through a lot of dark times, and I started studying Buddhism, I guess, to solve that, but it wasn't until I got sober and dealt with the drugs and alcohol that it all started to come together. You know, I was always drawn to meditation and spirituality. I was a musician for many years, and so, you know, the Beatles were my first inspiration, and eventually I discovered Buddhism and as you say, mindfulness, and started to really live my life very differently.
Wow. Becoming sober in itself is an art, and staying sober is, again, you know, a discipline, and addiction is, in a certain way, it's very simple, but then again, in other ways, it's very complex. What do you think helped you become sober the most, or can you feel that space where you made that decision, or give us some input about that?
Yeah, you know, I think that I never wanted to really acknowledge that was a problem for me. I kind of figured that I needed to solve all the rest of my problems first. And finally, I just found that I couldn't solve my problems as long as I was, you know, getting high all the time and drinking.
Isn't that like certain musicians, isn't that sort of very attracted to them because of the side effects of creativity and other things that drug and alcoholism brings for a while before it dumps you, you know, down your path?
Yeah, maybe. I think that one of the things that I've come to see is that, you know, there's a kind of getting high, being altered in an altered state, is in some ways, you know, confused spiritual path. Like it's a misguided kind of spirituality. You're longing for something, and yeah. So I think a lot of artists are longing for that as well, and it's kind of like you pick the wrong solution or the wrong path. You know, the idea that alcohol is called spirits, you know, is kind of resonates for me, that it is kind of a way that we try to get something spiritual, but it's not real. And so, yeah, I think a lot of artists and creative people find themselves, you know, drawn into something like that without realizing where it's really leading.
And also the word high, you know, we speak about
yeah.
purifying
yeah.
our vibrations and raising our vibrations, and then all of a sudden somebody gives you something or presents something to you that gets you high. I mean, that's just an imitation for what the real spiritual energies are. So
yeah.
I guess a lot of it is very misleading. You have a book called Buddhism and the 12 Steps Workbook.
Yeah.
Wow. How do you combine those two?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. That was something that took me a long time to solve in a way, because I was interested in Buddhism, and then I was working the 12 steps in a 12-step program, but I couldn't see how they fit together. But eventually I started to see some connections, and in Buddhism, just like in the 12 steps, we start with our suffering, or we start with the problems or the challenges of life. And it's kind of, you know, the kind of archetypal spiritual journey of starting in the darkness and seeking the light. The path of the 12 steps says we want to turn our will and our lives over. And although they use the language of theism, of God, in Buddhism we also... we turn our lives over to more the path, I would say, you know, so that it's not so much a external being, but the path is very powerful. I see the path as being a higher power, so we call that Dharma in Buddhism. And so then there's the 12 steps ask us to go through a deep self-examination, and really an honest self-examination, and taking responsibility for our mistakes. And again, this is something very, connected to Buddhism, that through our meditation we're trying to look deeply into ourselves and see the truth of our shortcomings and the truth of our beauty, or our inner wisdom, and find that. So to me, it turns out that I think they're both calling upon something more archetypal or primal, that human spiritual journey that each of us is on, and hopefully each of us is aware that we're on. And so, to me, any spiritual journey, if you break it down, has these elements, the elements of, you know, coming into the light, the element of searching for the path, the element of truth, of seeking the truth, and awareness, and of course mindfulness, that awareness that Buddhism emphasizes is key to every stage of the spiritual journey.
Well, you know, I teach a lot of healing, and I say if you own it, you can heal it. And of course, you know, the very first step is admitting what your addiction is. And I find that sometimes people get more juice, more light out of having the experience of being on the healing path than out of the healing itself. You know, that's for the other people. And being on the path is very, very rich. When you stop being and start doing, you start losing your connection. Does that make any sense to you?
Yes, absolutely. The idea that we are human beings, not human doings, and it's not about making something happen, as it is being present and alive in each moment, and then engaging the moment and responding. And sometimes there's some action that comes out of that, but it starts with that capacity for just being. If we're always trying to make something happen, then we're in a reactive mode instead of being in that receptive, intuitive mode.
And there's something about people who are slightly a little bit smarter than other people, have a higher IQ, that they seek out more control. You know, they want to do it their way. There's no spontaneity. Yeah. There's, you know, very little chance for God to step in and give you synchronicity, and the angels step in and to line things for you, because sometimes that being in control, which maybe I'm an alcoholic and I can heal it anytime I want to, I can stop,
Right.
has a tendency to ruin the path. Now, you also had a previous book, which was Before the Buddhism and the 12-Step.
Well, the Buddhism and the 12-Step Workbook is my third book. So my first one is called One Breath at a Time, and that was where I just introduced people to these ideas. And then my second book is called A Burning Desire, and that's about trying to understand the concept of higher power from a Buddhist viewpoint, which is very difficult for many people. Many people really struggle with the concept of God these days. You know, we kind of have this split in our culture for some reason where people want to take sides. You know, you're either, you know, believe in God or you're an atheist, and I don't really take sides in that debate. I believe that there are powers in the universe, and that's quite obvious that there's powers. Gravity is a power, you know, and it's just a matter of working with those powers. Anyway, those are my three books now. I'm writing too many of them, I'm afraid.
Amazon.com carries Kevin Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, and you can also find him at kevingriffin.net. Kevin, yes. GRIFFIN.net has a wonderful website where you can listen to his music. I didn't get a chance to listen to your music. What do you play?
Well, I play lead guitar, and my music, the CD I made is kind of a culmination of, you know, many years of experience, and I wanted to do something really uplifting, kind of, I call it world beat, basically. It draws from a lot of rhythmic, you know, influences, African, reggae, Latin rhythms. Most of the lyrics have kind of Buddhist themes, but some of them are very playful. Laughing Buddha is the name of the CD, so that gives you an idea that it's not too serious. So it's really upbeat, fun music, dance music.
Well, Laughing Buddha is definitely going on my list to
watch
soon. Now, what do you think is the greatest spiritual experience you ever had that you can share with us? What do you think that would be?
Well, the most transforming day of my life was the day I woke up and realized I couldn't drink and use anymore. And at the time, I didn't think it was a spiritual experience at all. I thought it was just, you know, I was just having to give up, and it was, you know, kind of frustrating and difficult. But now I see that started me on my journey. That being said, you know, I've spent a lot of time in silent meditation retreats, and so I've had some very powerful moments of, you know, kind of transcendent bliss that of just sitting in silence and the heart opening and the mind just completely spacious, and you know, that's pretty beautiful. I'm not sure if it has a meaning or accomplishes anything, but there's nothing like silence to allow me to, or allow us to touch something very, very deep. And we don't have very much silence in our culture, in our lives these days.
No, we don't. I remember where was I, in Siliguri, India, 1960-something, and I had to do 30-day silence, but I was around 300 people.
Uh-huh.
I think, you know, day six, I asked for the salt and had to start all over again. But what really surprised me, and this is a term I use a lot, it's called chit-chat, and all the shit, the thoughts that I was mouthing in my brain that had nothing to do with anything that were opinions, that were just that voice, that just keep that voice constantly going so I wouldn't have to be alone with myself.
Yeah.
And listening to that and begging and praying for the silence was just such a great lesson to me about how many unneeded thoughts go through my head, how much judgment and how many opinions I had. And that was pretty scary, you know, to think that, well, this is what I do all day long to stay away from the peace,
yep.
to stay away from that silence. And it was pretty scary to me to realize that from morning till night I would be thinking about something,
yeah.
but it
yeah.
wasn't important. You know, that's scary. We have
amazing.
Like 50,000 thoughts in our head in a day about
yeah.
nothing.
I know. It's very strange what our minds do, and that's obviously something that Buddhist meditation is really engaging and kind of asking in a way, what's going on and why am I making this noise in my head? Because when we discover the joy of silence, of when the mind does quiet down, it's so pleasant that you wonder why you would want to start thinking again. I mean, in that way, you're describing that way in which we just blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I've come to understand it as actually very much based in evolution and survival. The human mind, you know, the thing that makes humans distinct and has allowed us to be, you know, the dominant species on the planet is our capacity to think. And so it's in our DNA that we need to think in order to survive, just like another animal might think that they need to, you know, run in order to survive, or jump or fly in order to survive. For us, it's we need to think in order to survive. So it's very much kind of against our evolutionary sort of momentum to stop thinking.
Well, you know, there's all that chit-chat, and then there's mindfulness, and you seem to
yes.
Have a lot of this in your teaching.
Yes.
Kind of define that for our listeners and talk to us about that. What is
yeah.
mindfulness?
Mindfulness is a kind of, it's a certain way of being present in which we are both very engaged with our sense experience and kind of observing as well. So there's like a kind of double way that we experience it. It's so that we start to notice how what we're experiencing, but then we notice how our mind intervenes, just the way you were talking about your experience in India. So we start to be able to actually choose and more intentionally be present, noticing our judgments, just the way you said that, you know, noticing our reactions to things, and being able to then more intentionally choose what we're going to pay attention to, choose what we're going to think, choose how we're going to react to things. So it's really, it comes down to that being present and not being lost in our thoughts, not being caught up in our reactivity, our emotional outbursts, but really being aware and conscious moment by moment so that we can more wisely engage each moment.
I agree. You know, I remember back in the 70s, I taught a class on impeccability, and somebody had used a Kleenex and threw it on the floor. And I remember the 12-year-old boy leaving the class with his mother was the only one who picked up the Kleenex.
Uh-huh.
And in your mindfulness, there's also a high awareness of what is out of order. You know,
right.
You see some trash, or if you see that your chair isn't pushed in or that you're in somebody's way, it becomes a place of observing the order and disorder, not only inside of you, but in the world. And mindfulness, you know, for me, when it first came, it came in a couple of hours, and then I'd forget, and then it came back, you know, 3-4 days later, in 8 or 10 hours. And I had to culture it. I had to culture being mindful. You know, I've seen people walk up to somebody and ask them, how are you? And they're crying, and the person says, fine. And then they walk away. You know, and I look at this and I go, okay, this is a place for healing and growth for this person. Yeah. But mindfulness is very, very big, yet it's very, very silent. I mean, you just do the things that are supposed to be done. And without having to say, should I pick it up, should I not pick it up, should I move this, should I move that, without a lot of that chatter going on. Yeah. And I find mindfulness very empowering.
Yes, I agree. And I think you're really getting at it, too, that there's a kind of clarity that comes where we don't have to, you know, think too much, that we kind of intuitively respond to situations. We know it's clear how to behave. Certainly it's a practice. I mean, it takes practice. This is why people do mindfulness meditation on a regular basis, I try to do that every day. And it's, nowadays they're doing a lot of research into the brain and how the mindfulness affects the brain, and clearly we are, when we practice mindfulness in a formal way, we are developing and kind of strengthening certain parts of the brain so that then we're more likely to be mindful. Because as you said, you know, you forget to be mindful, and that's kind of the hardest part of it, is just to remember, oh, I need to be present. I need to not be caught up in thinking about tomorrow or worrying about yesterday or judging this person. I just need to be present and remind myself to do it. So that training, mind training, I hear people calling it these days, I think is really key. And it's good to see that scientists are actually coming around to seeing, just as they do with, you know, as they have with other spiritual practices, seeing that this isn't just hocus pocus. It's a real, real thing that's happening in the brain.
I think it's important. Is there anything else you need to share with us or want to share with us about people and recovery, and any gold nuggets or pieces of wisdom that you have to share with us for those people?
You know, the thing that I think is the most important for us is to be honest with ourselves about, particularly for someone who is kind of questioning whether they have a problem or not, is to really honestly assess what your addictive behavior or whatever the thing you're facing, what it's doing to your life, and whether it's really improving your life. Because it's, I think a lot of people, either they are in denial about the problem, or else they don't feel as if there's a solution. And there absolutely is a solution. There are, you know, many ways to deal with addiction. Obviously the 12 steps and then some of the Buddhist practices, but there's other paths too, smart recovery. And so if someone knows, if you're willing to admit, if you can see clearly that it's not helping your life, then I think you've got to make the commitment to change. If we really are honest with ourselves, you know, we'll see whether it's working or not.
And now, I think for me, the biggest wake-ups and lights in my life were when I surrendered. And, you know, I surrendered to God and surrendering. And that was a decision that I made. And every time when I came to a point in my life where I felt lost, there were seven paths in front of me, and I needed to take one or tried to take two at the same time or three. When I surrendered and made that decision, that whole idea of making a decision, and I think you talked about that someplace on your website, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
About making decisions was so important to me, to surrender. And I think decisions, making decisions in your spiritual path are really important. What do you care about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just as you say, that surrender. Because, I mean, it's true, I think, for all of us, but particularly for addicts, that as you were talking about, people want to control things. And, you know, fundamentally, we aren't in control of this world. We have some influence over the direction of our lives, but when we're trying to run the show, we just wind up in this state of real conflict with the world, with people, with ourselves. And it's hard to surrender because it's scary, you know. It's to give up control. You know, not a lot of people don't feel, you know, safe doing that.
Yeah, like God would take care of them, or that the world would find a place for them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have this great geodesic dome that seats 200 or 300 people, and if you were to come to teach here, what would you teach? What would you teach in your your classes?
Yeah. Well, I start by teaching meditation. So I usually spend a half an hour meditating with people, giving them guided meditation instructions, and then we explore meditation questions around that. And then I usually start people through kind of looking at the 12 steps through this Buddhist lens, looking at the idea of powerlessness of higher power, of inventory, and making amends, and all the spiritual awakening, that whole path. And that, you know, I will have retreats that last for 3 or 4 days where we really take a lot of time exploring these things. And then we continue to practice meditation. We'll practice, you know, in a day we might practice a couple hours of meditation, and then I like to people to work together too in small groups. So I'll ask them usually very simple questions to explore in a dyad or a triad, and it's very simple, you know.
We have a few minutes left before the break on the half hour. Can you tell me a little bit more about mindful eating?
Sure, yeah. Mindful eating is so interesting. First of all, mindful eating starts with just being very present with the experience of eating. So we take time to look at our food, to smell the food, to just be very open to it. And then the practice of mindful eating sort of requires slowing down a little bit. And, you know, you're not reading, you're not watching TV, you're not having a conversation, you're just eating. And, you take a bite. And in the exercise, in the mindful eating exercise, I have people just put a raisin on their tongue and just feel it, roll it around very slowly, then bite into it and taste, just be fully aware of flavor. It's amazing how much food we put in our mouths that we never taste. You know, further than, of course, when we're really paying attention with mindfulness, we're very attentive to our whole body, feeling our body getting full so that we're not overeating, and being sensitive to what we're putting in our body. So mindful eating can encompass then being aware of how hungry I am before I start to eat.
I know people, they eat an Oreo, they go unconscious, and then they eat half a bag, or they eat one potato chip, go unconscious, and they eat half a bag. And it's really amazing when you watch people eat and not chew or eat and not taste. It's really amazing to me. And sometimes people don't know the difference between good food and bad food.
Right.
Because they don't, haven't even consciously bothered to integrate what they're tasting.
Yeah, I've worked with some researchers who were trying to help people with their overeating, and one of the things they did was they actually had them eat some junk food very slowly, very mindfully, and people could taste the kind of fakeness of it. You know, they could taste how unhealthy it was. And
okay, Kevin,
so yeah,
we're coming up to our half-hour break here. So,
okay. Thank
you, Kevin.
All right, thanks.
You're listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. Once again, Star Fuentes.
Well, you can call us at 646-716-9663. We'll give you some confirmation. We'll tell you which path is lit up for you, and we'll interact with you. Kevin Griffin is at www.kevingriffin.net, and he combines Buddhism and recovery. Yeah, let's talk about that mindful eating just a little bit more. Did you ever taste that extra sugar or extra salt after you really tasted something?
Did I ever?
Yeah, you know how something is too full of sugar or too full of salt, and people just eat it? And with mindful eating, you can actually taste this is too much sugar.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, it's really changed how I the foods that I eat, because just things that so many of the processed foods are so full of sugar and salt that they actually don't taste good if you pay attention to them. If you're not paying attention, I guess they're okay. But it's
amazing how many people regard food as fuel. And how many people regard food as a part of living and in experiencing life? So pay attention out there. If you want to shape shift, take and get some education about mindful eating.
Yeah.
And then you can shift your shape a little bit. I don't want to say lose weight, because you always find it sooner or later again if you lose it. And what else would you, what else is in some of your classes, Kevin?
Well, these days I'm working with cultivating joy. And that one of the things that I found in my teaching is that a lot of times when people are working the 12 steps, that it turns into a lot of work. And not a lot of play, not a lot of fun. And so the thing I've started to emphasize a little more is really looking at how you can bring more joy into your life, or even just seeing the joy that's already there so that you can appreciate it. You know, when people start to, a lot of people when they're addicts, they think the only thing that's fun is to get high. And so when they stop, they just think, oh, well, the fun's over. Now I just have to work these steps all the time. And I don't think that's what recovery is about at all. I think recovery is about being happy ultimately. And so I'm trying to kind of help people to see what they need to look at in order to cultivate that in their lives.
You know, seeds of joy are everywhere. You ever see a kitten or a puppy? I mean, most people, when I see a kitten or a puppy, they're going to get a look on their face. You know, it's cute or how cute or something. And if you're to a place where children laughing and playing don't make you smile, and if you're in a place where the flowers aren't beautiful, you need to pick up those seeds of joy, because There are so many miracles on this planet, whether they look beautiful, smell beautiful, or don't, and just their very existence is a miracle. It's important to get those seeds of joy and cultivate that joy within you.
Absolutely. You know, I think people sometimes give up on the idea of being happy. You know, adulthood, you know, it's hard having work and children and responsibilities, and sometimes people just find themselves kind of with their nose to the grindstone. And one of the things that I think is so important is to actually find the pleasures that are inherent to even responsibilities. That is, you know, work. I want work to be joyful in some way, which doesn't mean it's always like smiling happiness, but the fulfillment of doing a job well, you know.
And completing it.
And completing it, exactly. I mean, this is for adults. For many adults, you know, doing work is the thing that gives them the most gratification. And if we sometimes we just have to remember that, you know, it's not even that we have to change our lives as much as kind of see, oh, you know, this works. Or, yeah, sometimes we have to see that, wow, I'm just working at a job purely to make money, and it's not making me happy. And, I mean, I know it's not easy for people to make money, but I do think that people make choices sometimes based on something other than being happy. And that's one of the things that's so important, to be able to say, well, is this what I really want, or is society telling me I need all this money, or that my parents want me to, you know, be a doctor? And, you know, it's really to ask ourselves what makes us happy. It's, you know, there's a lot of pressures.
Well, you know, and also people don't listen to what they're saying.
Right.
You know, they say stupid stuff. I'll never get ahead. You know, oh, life is so painful. And, you know,
yeah.
Earth is like a planet of yes. And whatever you think about the most at the end of the day, and if you think, oh, I got our bills, this is a planet of yes, you'll get more bills. And if you think how prosperous you are or how much cash you have, you'll get more cash.
Yeah.
And you talk about mindful speech, and it's very important to understand that not only what you say manifests, what you think manifests, but what you say tells it whether to manifest or not.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And people, again and again in healing, people say, come to me with stomach cancer, and they keep saying, well, it made me sick to my stomach when my brother did this, and it made me sick to my stomach when my boss said this, and it made me, and they have 200,000, it made me sick to my stomachs in their life, and all of a sudden they're wondering why they got stomach cancer.
Wow.
You know, and
yeah.
Mindful speech is very, very important.
Yes.
What do you have to say about mindful speech?
Well, it's one of the great challenges, just as you pointed out, because we're so kind of programmed. I mean, just a phrase like that, it made me sick to my stomach. It's, you know, we don't think about what we're saying and what its real meaning is. A lot of our speech is exaggeration, or it's to impress people, or it's even to, you know, project something about us. And it, you know, it, just as you say, it creates a belief system for us. And that belief system then manifests. So I've really learned to be much more careful about the words I say. It's something, I mean, I've been working on that for 20 years at least, and I think it's one of the hardest things, because I know that I'm very programmed. You know, as a child, you get programmed, and, you know, I came from a big family, and I was the youngest of five boys, and there was a style of speech, very sarcastic, that I learned to do, and it's hard if I'm not conscious, I fall into those patterns, I fall into those same things, so it again, if I can be mindful, then there's a huge shift that happens, and it affects me internally, and then of course it affects my relationships as well, because speech is really the way we relate. So it's amazing how broad the effect of being mindful with our speech is.
I had a couple of years called the dictionary years, and anytime I'd say something and a person's energy would shift one way or another, and I thought it was an okay sentence, I go look up the words in the dictionary. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I was really, really surprised. Uh-huh. I was teaching a class last weekend, and I said, what does the word rich mean to you? And someone said $10,000. Someone said $1,000,000. Someone said to be healthy. And, of course, I said chocolate. But when we speak to people, the definition that they have for our words may not be the same one we have for the words rich. Being a cook, it's you know, how much sugar, how much butter, how much, you know, is in it, in there. And for somebody else, we toss those words out there like everybody's in agreement with our meaning of the word.
Yeah.
And people get hurt, people leave. We're not even conscious that we said something inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had that experience in my teaching, because I work with, there might be 50 people at an event I'm teaching, and someone might really take something I say in a way that I didn't mean it, or just like you say, that their understanding of that phrase, and wow, it there is a responsibility, of course, when you're a public person. But you're right. I mean, I think to me, what you're pointing to is that part of mindful speech is paying attention to the listener. So that if there's some feedback from them, if we see something hitting them in a way that we didn't want it to, we can ask them what they thought we were saying. It's so important to make sure that people are understanding. Because language is all metaphor. None of it's
And if we look at NLP and we're a visionary talking to a feeler, or we're a feeler talking to kinesthetic or kinesthetic daughter, whatever, we don't sometimes even get rapport with people. And I'm just amazed at all the wonderful information there is about personalities, people types, NLP types, way people think. There's so much information out there to educate us to pay attention to what we're listening, pay attention to what we hear, pay attention whether we're going to, make that ring a bell or look good or sounds good to me. What choice of words you're even using in a situation.
Yeah.
I see that you taught mindfulness in elementary school. How did that go?
That's one of the sweetest things I've ever done. And there's an organization called Mindful Schools out in the Bay Area where I live, and they have a very simple program that they take into schools, and the first exercise we do, we just ask the kids to close their eyes, and then I ring a bell, and I say, when you can't hear the bell anymore, raise your hand. So, of course, then they will be the last one to raise their hand. So they listen very, very closely, and right there, they've learned what mindfulness is. They've had an experience of mindfulness, because they're not thinking about anything else except the sound of that bell. So we take them through these very simple exercises like that and start to show them what it means to be mindful of their breath. And then eventually we get them to try to be mindful of their emotions and of their speech and start to... It's really to cultivate, obviously, their attention so that their capacity, it's somewhat, as students, really can grow. They've found that it's been very effective just in terms of behavior in the schools. A lot of the teachers then, they'll adopt the exercises and use some of the things we do to help the kids to calm themselves down, to be more present. So it's really, really, it's a beautiful, teaching.
I can imagine. Kids are just like sponge. Hey, people, you can find Kevin Griffin, G-R-I-F-F-I-N, at kevingriffin.net. Also, all three of his books, and I think even his CD is on Amazon.
Play
with that. I see that you have a blog here, and you talk about the steps, and you talk about different things here. And what I really like are your exercises.
Uh-huh.
And are these exercises from the big book, or are these exercises that you are suggesting to the people?
Yeah, they're from me. The exercises on the blog are from my newest book, the workbook, Buddhism and the 12 Steps workbook. And I've been meaning to put up some more posts there. I get lazy about it.
Well, it looks like there's a lot
good.
People to read. It would probably take you quite a bit.
Peace, Star.
Yeah, probably would.
Hey, hon, what's up? Mark?
Okay, I got a caller for you. Hold on.
Great.
Okay, Lynn, you're on.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could give me a little insight into what's going on with my health lately. I seem to have, some problems that aren't healing quickly, and I'm not certain where and what to do to help them.
Okay, Lynn. My first feeling is that every time you make a major transition in life and you just don't jump one or two vibrational levels or spiritual levels, that your body heals differently. So in the past, recently, have you jumped a bunch of levels and things changed for you?
Because I'm kind of trying to experiment with what spiritual modality or healing modality I might feel is best for me to integrate.
Okay, so give yourself at least 24 hours between those healing modalities so that you can sense. Some modalities will actually slow your healing down so it can be more thorough. Some modalities will speed things up. And some modalities are modalities of grace. These modalities let you heal gracefully. So sometimes when you heal too quick, that area is tender, or you use more energy from one place or another. I think you'll be fine. There are three or four in particular modalities that you use that are very good for you, and I think you know what they are. Keep doing those. Keep doing those. And have you moved yet?
No.
Mm-hmm. I kind of figured that whole moving process is going to be a huge space for you where you can leave a lot of energy behind. Kevin, do you have anything to say to Lynn?
Gosh, no, I think this is your field, Star, so I'm going to leave.
Okay, that's okay. So, okay, Lynn, and I'll throw in some extra prayers for you.
Thank you both very much.
Right off the top of my head, have you ever done any one brain?
No.
Why don't you do a little reading on that and play with that for a little bit, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So there is a space where when another person talks to me, where I'm very mindful of the subtle vibrations that come out of their voice. If you pay attention to that, I can usually tell whether they're on path or off path, whether they need to turn, go forward, go backwards, or do something. And I'll say to my friends, don't you hear that? Don't you hear that disease in your body, in that voice? And my friends will say, no.
Right.
You know, so for me, I imagine I'm hearing something, or I've drawn conclusions from something out of their energy field or something that other people aren't getting, but it seems to work well for me.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful capacity.
It is, and talk about sometimes putting my foot in it. Oh, boy. Sometimes I'll tell something to someone about themselves they just quite haven't discovered yet.
Yeah.
That's the timing on that has to be really, really good.
Yes.
So what is your schedule for the next couple of months? Where are you going to be? I'm not quite seeing a calendar on your website.
Yeah, I'm not very busy, thankfully. My schedule is to take care of my daughter, who's 16, while my wife is away. And, I just finished recording 8 hours of audio for Sounds True that's going to come out next year.
Yeah, they're a good company. That's really nice.
And I'm doing a book with them as well called Recovering Joy. It's also coming out in a year from now, so we're going to start editing that soon. And my next retreat, it's actually sold out. It's at Southern Dharma in Asheville, North Carolina. Then in the fall, in September, I'll be at Kripalu Institute, which is in Western Massachusetts. That's a great place, a great yoga center. So, that's when I kind of kick in again.
Well, we'll have to talk to you. Maybe we can get you to Hot Springs, Arkansas next year sometime.
Is that where you have your dome?
My church, yes, I do.
Yeah.
And it's got interesting. It's got lots of nice water and crystals.
Yeah.
Anything else you're doing, Kevin, that we need to know about?
Gosh, I don't think so. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and really appreciate your work and your understanding of what I'm doing. I appreciate all your questions. So it was really great talking to you.
Oh, there was a part in my life where I was an adult child of alcoholics, and I sponsored people, and I did all the 12 steps and went through the big book and everything that was very important to me and my spiritual path.
Yeah.
So why don't we just take a few minutes to find out what I am doing. I am working on my autobiography right now. After being 75 years alive, I got some stories to tell. Boy, do I. From master teachers all over the world to my very competent and incompetent ways along the path. My next big project is called E8, and E8 is the theory of everything. I will be explaining best possible, since the formula is size of the Empire State Building, I will be explaining E8, and we will be taking a spiritual...
Hey, Star?
Yep.
You want to squeeze one more in?
Yep, let's do that.
Okay, Yvonne.
Hello,
hi,
Yvonne.
Star.
What's your question, sweetie?
Instead of a general question, I wanted to see if I could just do a general reading. I have so many questions.
You'd like a general reading. Okay, there's a place in your life where you're not pushing yourself far enough, and you come to this space two or three times before in your life, and you're not going through with it. What is it?
Following through being a healer and an herbalist.
Okay, so... whatever it is, get rid of it. Get rid of all the doubt. Get rid of all the fear and fully commit to it and fully step into it. God's Spirit will move mountains for you once you've made the commitment. And sometimes when you don't, it's like trying to step over a barbed wire fence. You got one foot in one field, one foot in the other field, and there's barbed wire catching you, your doubts and your fears. Take the leap, do the healing. Now, what is this with your relationship that's so confusing to me?
Relationship with...
significant other. Why is it not there?
I don't have one.
well, you made
a
vow.
I have an ex.
I'm going to tell you what happened. You made a vow. at some point in time you said, I will never love again.
Yes.
And you made this vow out of pain and out of anger and out of being hurt. I strongly suggest that you go to maybe MasterYourLight.com. And there was some vow removal stuff there. If not,
okay.
Email me, because it's been a long time since you've had a date, right?
Yes, I've been divorced 7 years, 8 years.
And you have not had a date, basically.
No, not since I was 16.
So you have a vow that you will never love again, or sex or love scares you so much.
Yes.
And what has happened is you got a little flashing sign, neon sign that says, I'm unavailable, no vacancy. So when people who are appropriate to date you come into your field, your energy field, they go, no, I'm not going to ask because I'm feeling this. So go and do some vow removal.
Okay.
See if whatever vow you made, you could rescind that vow and start being available to date and mate.
Okay. I have your fast track book, so I'll start working with that one.
Oh, yeah, that's in that. Anything else you'd like to know, sweetie?
How does one, with stepping into my power as a healer and an herbalist and combining those two, and how does one create a practice out of thin air, so to speak, because I have no network and no...
Do you have a phone book? I mean, do you have a personal address book and phone book? Do you have friends on Facebook?
I have acquaintances.
You have acquaintances. Well, you
I wouldn't call them friends necessarily.
You need to be committed to being a healer, and you need to present it to them that you're available for healing.
Okay.
And just remember the numbers. The numbers for Barbara Streisand, the numbers for me, it's... Two people out of 100 business cards will participate with me. Five people out of 100 brochures sent to people I know will participate with me. So really, what you need to do is start gathering information. You need to go to the vegetarian club. You need to go to the yoga place. You need to participate in the spiritual book club. People will come to you if they know you bodily, have met your body that goes with the name, more readily than if they just see your advertisement out there, okay? So you got to get out, go out two nights a week and once a month take a day-long workshop.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, sweetie.
Thank you so much.
So I believe that we get what we give, and if I want people to attend my workshops, and if I want people to read my books, I need to buy other people's books. I need to attend other people's workshops. I need to be out in that community. Do you get that, Kevin, that it's very important to participate?
Absolutely, exactly. I mean, when if someone says, oh, how do I become a teacher, I say, well, why don't you start by helping a teacher and getting out there and being part of a community? Absolutely. We're not independent entities. We all need to be part of our communities. And just as you're pointing to, we all need to constantly be learning and studying and taking in new ideas and new teachings.
Right, and that's kevingriffin.net. Oh, my website, masteryourlight.com. I have some new video classes up there that are really nice. I got a bunch of free material you can play with. I have audios at $2 a piece. I think I have 15 or 16 up there. I've got 500 more to put up, so just wait and see if I hit your topic. Participate. Participate with Kevin. Participate with me. Participate with spiritual leaders. This is how you move down your path. It's not enough just for you to walk in a classroom and pay the money. It is important to help them with their logistics and help with them, be with them in times when they're not teaching, so that you can get the download to become a teacher, so you can become successful in whatever they have been successful for. So this is Star saying good night, and thank you, Kevin Griffin.
Thank you, Steph.
On behalf of Spiritual Connections Radio, thank you for listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Please join us again next week for another enlivening episode. For more information on Star's classes or services, visit her website at www.starfuentes.com or call the office at 501-609-